Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. Well, Yogi Berra, you know Yogi Berra? I guess we could turn this up a little bit. Yogi Berra died last week, and he was age 90. Do you all know who Yogi Berra was? I mean, do you have to be of a certain age to know who Yogi Berra was? He was a famous, famous catcher, one of the best catchers in baseball that there ever was in baseball. And he was a catcher for the Yankees. Basically, during their biggest run of success from the, maybe it wasn't their biggest run, but one of their great runs of success, which I witnessed as a kid, as a fan, a Yankees fan, from the late 40s to around the early to mid 60s. And that was a team that had Roger Maris, Mickey Mantle, Whitey Ford, and many other people on it. But Yogi Berra was the catcher. And though I'm not a big fan of statistics, I think there are too many statistics in sports these days. Yogi Berra, in fact, had one of the best hitting streaks, one of the best averages over a period of whatever it was, 19, 20 years that he played, and he was a terrific defensive catcher. So he was one of the best catchers there ever was. And I didn't know the man. I saw him on interviews. I saw him play on the field a million times. Not live, but often saw him on TV. And he seemed like a really decent guy. Later on in his life, he was a coach and a manager, coach for the Mets and the Yankees, coach and a manager. So Whitey Ford gone. And I was a big fan of the of the Yankees. Why? I was a fan of the Yankees, and it was perverse for me to be a fan of the Yankees because I lived in a neighborhood that was mostly Dodgers and Giants fans. These are people who had been transplanted from the inner city, from the Bronx and from Brooklyn and various other places, parts of Manhattan. But there was mostly Dodgers and Giants fans, and the Yankees were considered too, I don't know why, but they were considered sort of upper class and snobby. Maybe they had higher salaries. I don't know what the origin of that was, but the Yankees were, they had, it was considered that they had, they were a fan for, they were a club for the rich, for the rich. But I don't know. There was a lot of people in the city who were not rich who rooted for the Yankees. But so in my neighborhood, it was perverse. It was perverse for me to be a Yankees fan. But there were other reasons why I was a Yankees fan. Part of the perversity was my father, who I had a pretty poor relationship with at the time, hardly ever saw him, and he was very different than me, a very different kind of guy. He left home when I was about four and in return. But my father was a very, very strong Brooklyn Dodgers fan. And like a lot of other people, when the Dodgers and then later the Giants moved to the West Coast in the mid to later 70s, he sort of lost his interest in baseball, but he was still interested in basketball. He was a big Knicks fan, but my father was always talking about the great Dodgers and telling me about, you know, the games he went to and how the Dodgers were great. But you know, because I was very angry at my father all the time for having left and for other kinds of behavior that he demonstrated, I sort of naturally rooted for a team. He was always going on like other Dodger fans did. The Dodgers were called the bums. They were the team for people who were, you know, poor, regular, common folk. And my father was certainly grew up that way and considered himself that way. So because I had an attitude about my father, I also rooted for the Yankees. But and also one of the reasons why I was a Yankee fan was that I liked it to win all the time. The Yankees were winners. They always won all the time. And I was essentially, not just how I looked at myself, but I was kind of a, well, maybe it was, but I was sort of a loser. You know, I was one of the only kids in the entire neighborhood, this lower middle class, sort of very father knows best neighborhood. I was one of the only kids who had didn't have a father and whose mother was crazy, who was in and out of mental hospitals. And I was very short, shorter than all the girls in my class till I was, till I got to be 12 years old, till I was in the seventh grade. So all the way through, and even in the seventh grade, I started growing then. But even in the seventh grade, there was a class picture, I think, that I saw once. It could have been the sixth grade or the seventh grade, but they had everybody lined up by height and by, you know, by girls and then boys. And I was the shortest one in the class. And although I had plenty of talents, I was smart, I could run fast, I could, you know, play ball, which is something we did all the time. I felt like, and I was very skinny, too skinny and too small and shy and afraid of people and sort of afraid to mingle and be close to other people and, you know, to have friends. And I just thought of myself sort of as a loser. And there were other reasons why I was labeled that way, even by some people in my neighborhood. But so when I saw a team that was, I mean, the Dodgers and the Giants, they, you know, they won often enough, or they won sometimes. But the Yankees were perennial winners. They were always the American League champs, or it seemed like they were always the American League champs. They had the best hitters. They had the best catcher. They had the best pitcher. Generally, and they often won the World Series. It's one of those teams, if you see, again, statistics of teams that have won how many World Series, the Yankees are like in another, pardon the expression, another league. I think they've won something like 27 or 26 World Series, and most other teams, at the most, they've won something like 12 or 14 or 15, maybe at the most. So, yeah, I was a Yankees fan. I mean, there was, you know, in different parts of the city, and out on Long Island, I lived in Queens, but that's part of Long Island. In different parts of the city and Long Island, There was a lot of football. There was hockey. People were hockey fans, football fans, and, of course, basketball fans. And some of this also depended on, you know, if you were black or white in the city. And in those days, hard to be a fan of any professional team, I suppose, although you could be. But it was very complicated if you were black, because that was when they were just first, they had first integrated baseball and basketball too. Hockey was entirely white, and I suppose there are reasons for that. But football and basketball were just beginning to, and baseball were just beginning to have black players, and they had more and more as time went on. But for most of the kids in my neighborhood, and it was a segregated neighborhood, you know, like a lot of places in New York City in those days, and still, we lived in, the neighborhood we lived in was a white neighborhood, but it was baseball. I mean, in other places, you know, it was hockey, and sometimes people, and we all played basketball. Played basketball in the schoolyards. We played basketball in indoor courts, you know, in school. And there were indoor, you know, games, and there were, you know, leagues, but they weren't taken as seriously. But baseball was everything. Baseball was everything. We watched baseball on TV, and if we were really lucky and there was enough money, we got to go to some actual games. And I went to some games, too. And you could play in a little league, too, if you had fathers who, if there were fathers who were interested and motivated enough and had the time, because people worked hard in those days, like, you know, like they do now, but they were worn out when they got home from their jobs in this city. Most of them had jobs that were rough jobs, cops and delivery men and stuff like that, and they were just worn out. But on the weekends, they would, you know, bring some of the kids to some of the guys to Little League. And it was a boys thing. Baseball was a boys thing. There might have been some girl fans. It's true. There might have been some girl fans. There is a great memoir written by Doris Kearns Goodwin, who's a terrific historian, called Wait Till Next Year, about being a Dodgers fan when she was a girl. I forget where she lived. I guess she lived in Queens or Brooklyn. I forget where. Anyhow, And I was thinking about Yogi the other day, and it sort of touched off all kinds of things. When you get older, you know, I'm 70 years old now, you do tend to have a kind of, I don't know if this is natural for everybody at this age or when you get older, you have a more vivid memory. Some parts of the middle parts of your life disappear, but you have a more vivid memory, really vivid, graphic sometimes, of things from your childhood, sensations and things. And when I heard that Yogi died, because I was a big fan of his, along with all the other Yankees, you know, I was 8, 9, 10, 12, 15, whatever. And that's when they were, you know, champs and winning World Series. But I remember everything. We spent endless hours until sometimes it got too dark, throwing the ball back and forth. We all had our mitts, you know, which some people oiled and put the ball in and curled the mitt around the ball, so that it it kept its shape, and you know, you'd put some yarn, some twine around it, or something like that, to keep it curled around the ball. And we'd just, you know, toss the ball back and forth or throw it, pretend to be pitchers and catchers. We had these games of catch that lasted for hours sometimes it seemed. And we played stickball, and we just had these like endless catches, tossing the ball back and forth. And it was something that we did was we collected baseball cards, and it was a big, big, exciting thing to collect baseball cards. It was Topps. I don't know if there were any other companies now. I think there are several different companies that make baseball cards, but the company that made baseball cards in those days was called Topps, T-O-P-P-S, I think. And if you had enough money, it wasn't cheap. If you were a kid, you know, you needed more than just penny candy money. I saved up enough money. You could buy a pack of baseball cards, and I really don't remember what they cost. But and also, I don't remember how many were in there. I think there were like 6 or 8 new, brand new baseball cards, and it was the most exciting thing in the world. And we got these cards. We traded the cards. We flipped them. We matched them. We flipped them against the wall to see who could, you know, win somebody else's cards. And we were careful not to use too important a card. If we were flipping, you know, trying to beat somebody. But, you know, you're supposed to be straightforward and honest about this. You took a pack of your cards and you didn't shuffle them or anything like that. You didn't pick at them. So you could have a good player or a bad player or one who wasn't as good, and you would flip them or match them. You would just let them drift down to the sidewalk. And there was an art to all of this, of course. It was athletic. And then sometimes you just traded cards, you know, like one of somebody like you had Mickey Mantle, you know, it would be worth God knows how many other cards, you know, players, 250, 240 batters or whatever. And it was exciting to get these cards. You open up the Topps package, and it was this flat package. In it was a very thin, small rectangle of, and, you know, it's about the size of a baseball card. There was a size, there, what kept it rigid besides the card, there was chewing gum in it, bubble gum, basically bubble gum in it. And it was a hard, thin rectangle of bubble gum with this light coating of white sugar on it. I'm sure it's the worst thing in the world to eat. Terrible stuff, right? Who knows what it was made of and what it did to you? But you take that, and it was kind of hard and brittle, and you pop that in your mouth and you start chewing on that. And but then there were the cards, and it was so exciting to look to figure out who was in there. What cards did you get? Was it a bunch of just regular players or people you already had? And like everything else, they didn't put in. You know, I don't know how they distributed these cards. Did they have a system? But, you know, the really big players, if you were really lucky, the big players, you might get a big player. And how people opened cards could show, like, what their personality was, like a pack of cards. Some people would just immediately, like, spread them out to see what they had. And some people would fan them carefully, you know, fan them carefully, which is what I did, opening cards, you know, if you were playing poker, just carefully fan and open them to see what you had. And because you don't want to, it was such a big deal to get to open this pack of cards that you didn't want to just sort of blow the whole thing. You don't want to just, like, have everything happen at once. So you take this fresh piece of bubble gum and you put it in your mouth. Tasted delicious. Took a little bit to, you know, soften it up. And then you had the cards, and you open them up slowly, and you see who you got. And it was fantastic just to see these people. It was almost like they were appearing right in front of the actual people. I mean, if you were really lucky, like I say, sometimes you'd get a Mickey Mantle card, Duke Snyder, Hank Aaron, Stan Musial, you know, somebody really, some great. People throw this word around, hero, and I hate to do this, but these people, we idolize these baseball players. They were like, they were like our heroes. We didn't know, we were too young to know about the corrupt business side of it and the greed, you know, how the managers, rather not the managers, how the team owners cheated the players and treated them like serfs and slaves, you know, just traded them, and they were practically, you know, owned them and ran their lives and didn't pay them very much compared to what players make these days. But now it's gone in the other direction. It's these obscene salaries. But you know, we didn't know about that. We didn't know about the players not having any rights at all, and the managers being greedy and paternalistic, and sometimes in the worst way, making deals with each other. And we didn't know about if they were using drugs. In those days, it wouldn't have been so sophisticated, like steroids, or if they were drunk, or if they were, God knows, if they were abusive, if they were. Taking Bennies, you know, Benzedrine to get up for the game or to kill, taking painkillers. We didn't really know any of that. All we saw is the cards. We saw them on TV. And like I say, if we were really lucky, we got to go to the game once in a while, got to go to a baseball game. And so I went to Yankee Stadium. Never went to Ebbets Field. Went to Yankee Stadium because my grandfather was also a Yankees fan. He was a Yankees fan. And the reason for that is my grandfather, of course, was the only male around. My uncle lived next door, but he couldn't care less about sports. Not interested in sports. But my grandfather, you know, he was a baseball fan, grew up a baseball fan. And grandfather, my mother's father, Louis, and he took me to see some games sometimes. You know, and he, something my father should have done, but he wasn't around. Later on, my father took me to see a lot of Knicks games, so that was great. But my grandfather, Louis, was the reason that he was a Yankees fan and took me to see the Yankees, because originally he was from Providence, Rhode Island. His family came from Providence, Rhode Island. So I don't know who he would have rooted for. But when he was in New York, he was a Yankees fan. And he was a Yankees fan because his boss, Louis was a lace trimming salesman. He worked in a garment center in New York City, and he sold lace in various forms, mostly for underwear and for trimmings, for dresses and other things. And his boss, who was very wealthy, you know, owned this big garment center factory and sales office, made friends with a lot of the Yankees. And one of the reasons for that was, in those days, some of the players got paid so poorly. They weren't making these giant contracts. For instance, in 1966, Mickey Mantle was getting paid more than any other player in baseball. He was getting $125,000 in 1966. And even if you multiply generously by inflation, that's no more than $1 million maybe, or $1.5 million a year. I mean, imagine a Mickey Mantle right now, how much he'd be making, right? Like I say, it's gone too far in the other direction, and $125,000 is a lot of money in those days. But a lot of players didn't get paid that much. They didn't get paid that much, and they weren't treated that well. And so a lot of people, and this is a problem, because people could have been open to bribery or whatever, and back in the day, way back, you know, there were cases like that. But a lot of these bosses and a lot of rich people who went to the games made friends with these guys, and, you know, just to sort of say, I'm pals with Mickey Mantle, I'm pals with these guys, they would give them, give their wives fur coats. And my grandfather's boss, who was, you know, a garment center guy, who was a clothing guy, he would give fur coats to the wives of the players, and sometimes buy them jewelry, and he would they'd give them money for, like, fancy vacations in the off season. And occasionally these guys didn't make enough money quite, and these guys got, like, no-show gigs, like celebrity gigs, jobs that they were on the books of this place. So that's why my grandfather knew these people. And, you know, that's why he could take me to the game. Sometimes, you know, he got free tickets to games. It was in the second deck, but sometimes he got free tickets to games. And that was the connection. That was the connection between them all. And like I say, in those days, baseball players were people that they were the ones we idolized. You know, I don't know how it was for other people, other kids, if they were into basketball or hockey or football, but we idolized baseball players. It was still the national pastime. So baseball players, those were the guys that we idolized, and baseball was our lives. It was everything that we did, and especially anything that was wrong with our lives, anything that went bad, you know, all you had to do, and, you know, on the weekends we watched TV. Sometimes, finally in the mid-50s, most of the families in my neighborhood had a TV. Mostly it was black and white. Later on, we got some color TVs in some of the houses. But baseball was our consuming passion, and it was something that we did all the time, and we lived and breathed baseball. So sometimes, no matter how bad anything else was that was going on in our lives, or how much trouble school was, or how much trouble it was just growing up, or what was going on in our houses, and in my house, it was a madhouse, literally. There was always baseball, and the baseball players, and the cards, and tossing the ball back and forth to keep us going.
Please, fellas, we need you.
Nellie Kelly, the baseball games, knew the players, knew all their names. You could see her there every day, shout hooray when they played. Her boyfriend by the name of Joe said,
to Coney Isle, dear, we'll go.
Then Nellie started to fret and pout,
and to him I heard her shout,
hey, take me out to the ball game, take me out with the crowd, buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack, I don't care if I never get back. Let me root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame, 'cause it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
Yeah, take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the ball game. My grandfather, Louis. I never knew my grandfather that well. I never knew my grandfather that well. I mean, he lived about a block and a half away, maybe two blocks away. I just never got to know him that well. I wasn't his kind of kid, and he wasn't my kind of guy. I mean, and he really, Louis, let me describe Louis. Louis was, I say, as a salesman, and he had a great smile. He was a handsome guy. He was completely bald when I knew him. When I was 10, he was about 60 years old, roughly. So he was older, and that seemed like very old when you're 10 years old. And he was bald by then, and he had been, you know, bald, I think, since his 30s, since maybe in his late 20s. And but he was a handsome guy, and he had a very handsome face, and he had a great smile, you know, like had a salesman's charm. And he had these beautiful blue eyes. Grandfather Louis had beautiful blue eyes, which was, in my neighborhood and maybe for some other neighborhoods, unusual for Jews to have blue eyes. And he had bright blue eyes, absolutely bright blue eyes, like Paul Newman bright blue eyes. And he was dapper. He was a snappy dresser. He was a snappy dresser. And he, because he was in a garment, you know, business, and he always had like the latest kind of suit on, and his shoes were always the latest kind of shoes, and they were polished, and he had really fancy socks on when he went to work, and he had a tie and a great shirt, perfect shirt, everything, and he had a hat. Every guy had a hat in those days, fancy hat. And he had all kinds of interesting quirks, like since he was traveling on the road off and on a lot in his life, and since he was a guy who would show up at different places and people would order, you know, various things from the catalog he had, it involved a lot of numbers. And sometimes he would try to teach me numbers, but it was hopeless. Teaching me numbers is like teaching, you fill in the blank, you know, teaching somebody who's totally incapable of ever learning it, teaching them something, right? But I could not learn numbers. But he would try, and he was interested about numbers. He only had a high school education. A lot of guys from his generation, did not go to college, obviously. And he only had a high school education, but he was very, very, very bright and very sharp. It's just that he never really studied that much, and he was more interested in things of the world rather than academics or scholastics. But when it came to numbers, he was an absolute whiz. I mean, he didn't read much either. My grandmother, who I'll talk about in a minute, his wife Rose, my grandmother Rose, my mother's mother, she was the intellectual. She was had been the academic and the intellectual. Any woman who went to college way back, my grandmother graduated from Hunter College in 1911. And I guess she met my grandfather sometime after that somewhere, probably at some Settlement Street, Henry Street Settlement Street dance or something, or maybe somebody introduced them. But a lot of women who went to college in the teens and the 20s, which was unusual, and even the 30s, maybe even later on too, like my mother. But women who went to college in those days were rare, and the field of men that they could marry usually were men who had high school educations, maybe, not even always college educations. And Louis did not have a college education, but he was sharp and he was fast, and he wasn't that academic. But he could add numbers upside down. That was the most fascinating thing. And sometimes we would do games, and I suppose that's his way of teaching me. We would do additions, and he'd write out this long column of numbers, double digits, sometimes triple digits, and he would look at it upside down and have a pad of his own, and I'd look at it right side up, and he was done about, you know, in a fifth the time that I was to add this up, because he grew up, you know, his professional life as an adult was sales, and he had to, when people were ordering things from the catalog, he was there with his pad, you know, and he would be writing things down, but he was showing people the catalog and showing them the things that they wanted, and people would be filling these things in on blank forms, and he'd add it up on his own separate pad. as he went along. And so he knew how to add numbers upside down, which was really fascinating. He was really fast. And Louis was also unusual in my neighborhood because he was a grandparent who was a second-generation guy. His family had come, or even third generation, his family had come to the United States before the huge wave of immigrant Jews who had come from from Central and Eastern Europe and Russia around from 1890 to around 1910 or 1920. And his family had come before that, so he didn't have any accent. There was no leftover accent, and he was very American in all his ways. He didn't have any leftover old country ways, kind of modern compared to a lot of our grandparents back in those days, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. His family had landed and settled in Providence, Rhode Island. Why, I don't know. I never got to meet his family very much. So he was unusual for being second, or I think it might have been third generation. He married my grandmother. I don't know where they met, but he married her. And my grandmother, Rose, she was the matriarch of the family. She was the matriarch. She ran everything. So she was not a good-looking woman. My grandmother, Rose, was, about 60 also when I... She was a couple of years older than my grandfather. But she was not attractive, and he was very handsome. But, go explain these things. She was not, but she married him, and she, I think they loved each other, but it was hard to tell with my grandmother how she felt about men, because mostly my grandmother, from what I could tell, and this extended to a lot of different men in the family and other men entirely, my grandmother had a kind of contempt, or she had disdain, even contempt for men. Now, I don't know what happened. She grew up with seven brothers and sisters. She was the middle sister of seven brothers, rather. My grandmother grew up in a family where she was the only sister with seven brothers, and she was in the middle. And I have no idea, what it was like for her back in those days, where they were all, the boys were always, like, featured. They were the stars, and girls were played down. But she and all these guys turned out to be very ambitious, like that whole generation, doctors, lawyers, engineers, people like that. But my grandmother grew up with a kind of, like I say, a disdain and a contempt for men. And she couldn't stand my father, for instance. One of the reasons my father took off was that he had a war with my grandmother, and basically he lost, and my mother, my poor mother was really sort of crazy, and my grandmother just blamed men for all kinds of things. I'm surprised she even liked me at all, but she was good to me. She liked me a lot, and they were but a little bit different. My grandmother was a modern person because she had gone to college, and that was unusual for somebody in her generation, very unusual. Like I said, she graduated in 1911, but she was still sort of, she had a lot of old country ways. She had, she used to hang garlic, whole cloves of garlic up in her kitchen, which she used to cook. And she cooked old country stuff like borscht. She was an immigrant. She was, what do you call it, first generation, I guess. My grandmother came over as a child from, Poland, but those countries kept changing borders all the time. But she was an immigrant, and she married this guy who was a modern, snappy guy. And like I say, although she didn't like men at all, my grandmother, I believe that my grandfather and my grandmother really loved each other. She loved my grandfather. But he basically did what she told him to do. And maybe that's one reason she married him. I don't know. Because any man that came into that family, and that's why my father couldn't stand being in that family after a while, and for other reasons. Any man that came into that family, like my uncle who lived next door, had to knuckle under. They had to knuckle under. I had an uncle, my grandmother's only son, my uncle Leonard, who basically took off. He took off. He couldn't hang around in an atmosphere like that. But my grandmother ran the show. So any man that married into this family had to do what she told him to do, and had to be sufficiently sort of subservient and second class citizen to any woman who was in the family, especially her. And like I say, Louis was a ladies' man. He was very charming, and women liked him. And he liked girls, and he liked women. I don't mean that he was, you know, unfaithful or anything like that. But he really preferred dealing with, you know, he was a good salesman, men and women. But he preferred hanging around with, you know, like he got along with my sister a lot better than he got along with me. And he could not find anything in common with me. I just don't think he had trouble. You know, sometimes fathers or grandfathers have more interest and sort of more natural ability with little girls than little boys. So that's how it was with him. But he tried to do the right thing because I had no father, right? And since baseball was everything, he, you know, occasionally he would get some tickets to a game. They weren't, you know, really good tickets, but they were tickets, and they were up in the second deck. And we'd go to a game once every, I don't know, during the season, maybe once every 6 to 8 weeks. So I went to a few games when the Yanks were at home, and got to see them play on the field, which was a wonderful thing. Now, my father's side of the family was a whole different thing. My mother's side of the family, like I say, was a matriarchy. My grandmother ran it. And they were uptight, neurotic people, which they passed down successfully very much to me. Somewhat to my sister, but much more to me. A kind of melancholy, somewhat negative attitude about the world, afraid of things, uptight, kind of, you know, like I say, neurotic, worried side of the family. And I suppose most of them were that way. My father's side of the family, who I hardly ever got to see because of this really nasty divorce and the fact that my father couldn't get along with anybody else really very much in my family, especially my grandmother who ran the family. When I went to see my father's family, they were completely different kinds of people. They were very large. They ate a lot. They laughed a lot. They were uninhibited. they told loud jokes. They drank a little too much sometimes. They ate, like I say, they ate a lot. They were big people, and they were sort of larger than life, and very smart people. Well, college, you know, graduates, you know, professionals, most of them. But my mother's family, who I grew up with, my aunt next door, and especially my poor mother and my grandmother and my grandfather, all those people, they were very, very grim, and they could be petty and cynical and nasty, and men, like I say, were not considered to be, you know, much in that family. And there, part of this was because it all revolved around my mother. There was some, she was like mentally ill since she was a child, since she was young. She was very, very smart, but she was very, very ill. And when I was growing up, she had terrible fits and threatened suicide, was put into mental hospitals, and it was just a horror scene all the time. In fact, yesterday, and that's one reason I'm kind of more jumpy even than usual today, was the anniversary of my mother's suicide decades ago, but still it clutches me. It's still, if you know, I mean, because it's something I had to deal with personally, and it still clutches me. But there was some terrible family secret also. There was an awful family secret that that involved my mother, and nobody ever really discussed it, but it had to do with some kind of, like, maybe I'm guessing, but it had to do with some kind of, like, really awful, like, molestation or sexual thing. It had to do with an uncle of mine, a granduncle, actually, one of my grandmother's brothers. And I'm not really sure about this, but I have a pretty good feeling about it. So this whole family was run by my grandmother, who didn't like men to begin with. And then there was all this this strangeness about an undisclosed or undiscussed or unacknowledged but certainly existent family secret that involved my mother. And all of this craziness and this uncomfortableness and this fact that nobody could relax and nobody laughed very much and everybody was very grim and tense, concerned all the time, throughout all of that, one of the only normal things in my life that was a regular thing that ran all the way through this was the baseball. It was the baseball, you know, the cards and everything else, you know, the going to the game, you know, trading cards, all that kind of stuff. And like I said, we watch games on TV. My father got a TV before a lot of, he got a TV in our house in 1950, before a lot of other, I was 49 or 50. And this is before a lot of other families had a TV because he was very into, he was an engineer. So he was very into gadgets and stuff like that. He loved gadgets. Anything that was new, a new invention, he loved to, and especially liked the TV. And those TVs were old black and white TVs. Sometimes they had rabbit ear antennas, and they were they were kind of funny looking. Nothing like what the modern flat screen TV looks like. And often the picture would go out of focus. They didn't broadcast 24/7. There was only something like 11 channels, or I think 9 or 11 channels, and that was it. There was no cable TV, so there wasn't, you know, 2,000 channels. There wasn't a Martian food channel, and there wasn't, you know, trade in your old silverware channel or whatever. It was just you watched what they showed you, and it was very limited and black and white. Later on, I think it was the mid-50s when people started getting color TVs, and ultimately we got a color TV. But so we watched the games. Watch the games, usually on weekends. Watch the games and broadcast on weekends. I don't even remember in those days. I think the seasons were 154 games long. I don't remember. Yeah, they were. But I don't remember when they changed it to 162 games. And that was really because of TV, because so many people were watching TV and they could sell commercials. They wanted to extend the amount of games so they could make more money. There was no other reason for it. 154 games seemed like a lot, but 162 games is it's a lot more, especially, I guess, if you're a player. But did they play night? I don't know when night games came into being. That's something I don't know either. I would have to guess. I don't know when they installed all those lights in parks and started playing night games. But most of the games that that I went to were. You know, because I was a kid, too, and there was school the next day or whatever. I didn't stay up so late. And the Bronx was a long trip, though. My grandfather drove up there. He had always had a nice new Chevrolet, whatever year it was. He made some decent money at being a salesman. And so we went to the games, and we're always day games. And on the weekends, we'd watch on TV. And they had one announcer. They didn't have, like, four different announcers. They didn't have color commentators. If you watched whoever your favorite team was, if you watched Dodgers, it was Red Barber. He called himself the old redhead, though he was slightly bald. And he had this, like, beautiful southern lilt to his voice, and he was a wonderful announcer. And if you watched the Yankees, it was Mel Allen. Mel Allen, who also came from down south. Forget what his actual name was. It was Melvin Allenberg or something like that. But Mel Allen, you watched, and he had a bit of a southern accent too. But the thing was, it was a slower, simpler thing. There weren't graphics and ribbons running all along the bottom of the screen. I will never get used to ESPN's goddamn ribbon running across the bottom of the screen. I don't want to know all that stuff, and it takes your eye off it. And now, ESPN, I notice I'm watching a lot of ball games, watching the Mets and the Yankees as they near the end of the season and head into the playoffs. there's even a new improvement. They can't stop at the graphics. It's like masturbation. They just can't stop doing it. Compulsive masturbation. Because they can do it, they do it. Now they're putting a box in over home plate, which is what the strike zone would be. So you don't even get to watch, you know, the player and judge for yourself. You don't watch the ball hit the glove or the player, you know, holding off or maybe a check swing. If it doesn't go into the box, it's not straight. Leave the box out of it and all the ribbons running across it. And so when you watched in those days, you just watched the ball field. Yeah, they had ads in the outfield, but they didn't have all the fireworks blowing up. They didn't have these giant screens. They didn't have ribbons, make noise, applaud, all this stuff going on and off all the time. It's just nuts. It's completely crazy. But it was so simplified and relaxing to just even watch the game on the and if you went to the game, you'd have to deal with all that crap, you know, on the graphics and everything else. You just watch the game. And one announcer, And if there was nothing particularly going on, he didn't feel the need to fill in every second with all this gibberish and all this talk. He didn't feel that need. The game was a slow game. And compared to basketball to football and to hockey, certainly, baseball, one of the joys of baseball, of playing baseball and of throwing the ball back and forth, but of playing baseball and of two joys, really, that I felt. One was that it was slow. It was like a gigantic, slow chess game. I mean, tremendous athleticism involved, of course. And when the bat hit the ball and when a pitch was really good or a great play in the infield or the outfield or a double play or some extraordinary thing like a booming home run, which you'd see from Mickey Mantle sometimes and other players, or some diving catch. And you still see all that wonderful athleticism all the time. But when there wasn't something spectacular going on, when the teams were, there were breaks for commercials, sure. It was always brought to you by some various companies. Again, there wasn't all these flying graphics and crazy things going on and on. And if something was happening on the field, they were changing a... they didn't break for a commercial every second that they had an opportunity. If they were bringing in a new pitcher, if they were bringing in somebody from the bullpen, they didn't necessarily do anything. They just brought somebody new in. And the announcer would talk for a little while about what was going on. But if there was a lull in the game, and in baseball there are lulls. That's one of the joys of baseball, aside from seeing the you're able to see it. Like, for instance, I'm sure that in basketball and in hockey and in football, certainly in football, there are all these tactical things going on every second. I mean, you have to watch and see every movement. Everybody is placed a certain way, and you know who the players are, what they're going to do, and you have to figure it all out. But baseball is even far more complicated. It's like a huge chess game that's going on all the time between the managers and the coaches and the players and people shifting, and they know who they're pitching to. And they know what they're doing, right? But when you look at it from the outside, I mean, you could participate in that as a viewer or as a fan going to the game. You'll say, they shouldn't be pitching to him, or they should pitch lower to him, or this guy. So we knew about the players. We knew what the pitchers were like. We knew what the strengths of the players were. We knew who was good at their position defensively. But they didn't have all this trivia, and they didn't feel the need to fill in everything every minute. So you were left more with your own, it pulled you in more and gave you more room and space as a human being to use your brain and your heart to participate in the whole thing. They weren't telling you every second, like, this is, he has hit successfully for the last 2 years every other Thursday in evening games. Who was the last person on the Mets to get three triples three games in a row, in night games? I don't know, and I don't care. There's this need, this crazy need, which goes beyond, I think, the human brain to absorb and the human heart to desire to fill you in every second about what's going on and to give you all these details. If you want to know a little bit about what a baseball game was like, although it's far more complicated than that, but there is one of the best books ever written, and I mean one of the best American novels ever written. It's called Underworld by Don DeLillo. Don DeLillo. And the opening chapter, which is a long chapter, is about a 1951, a famous game between the Giants and the Dodgers, 1951, to decide who was going to win the pennant that year, the National League pennant. And if you ever want to read about what the atmosphere was like for people who were baseball fans and what the game was like, you read about that. But my grandfather took me to these games. And when I got to be, when I was like 8, 9, 10, 12, but when I was 15 years old, he was still taking me to games. But I noticed, this is after the fact, every once in a while he told me when we were going up these landings and these ramps, he would pause. And he would get a little bit of a pained look on his face. And I figured, well, you know, the guy's older. I mean, it was a generation that didn't tell you everything that was wrong with them all the time. But he paused and he said, Mike, you go ahead up and I'll catch you up in a minute. I got my ticket. And so I'd go ahead. I said, I'll stay with you, Grandpa, you know. He said, no, you go ahead. You know, I'm just going to stay here for a second just to catch my breath. And that was a couple of games he did that. One game he took me to, by the way. Here I am remembering. He took me to see Don Larson pitch the, not on purpose, you know, but we didn't know it was going to happen. I was at the game in 1956 when Don Larson pitched a perfect game in the World Series. Pitched a no-hitter. Was it a perfect game or a no-hitter? I forget which. I think it was a perfect game in 1956 World Series. And we didn't know that till around the sixth or seventh inning, and then everybody finally got very quiet, and every pitch, you know, you leaned forward and paid attention to. But my grandfather, the last couple of games he took me to, he was pausing at these ramps. They didn't really think anything of it, because otherwise he seemed to be okay. And one day, when I was 15, it was in the summer during the baseball season, they told me to go over to my grandfather's house, my grandmother's house, and there was an ambulance outside, and my grandfather was there with this really scared look on his face. And he walked into the ambulance, but before he left, he gave me a quarter. He said, I want to give you this quarter. Be a good boy, and here's this quarter. And he walked into the ambulance, and I never saw him again. He died in the hospital from a heart attack. And later on, we were in a house sitting Shiva, which is this mourning period for Jews when people come over. And I got a couple of calls from the baseball players. One was Hank Bauer and another guy, Billy Richardson, I think. And it was hard for me to believe it at first. But they were calling up to ask how my grandfather was. So this was my intimate connection with them. And Yogi Berra dying the other day brought this all back to me, all of this stuff in great graphic detail, the family stuff, the baseball cards, everything else. So here's to Yogi, and here's to my grandfather, Louie. I never really knew you very well, and I wished I knew you better. And after all this time, maybe one day I'll get to know you someplace, some other place. But I'm glad I had you as a grandfather, and I'm glad I knew you, Yogi, too.
He hung up his coat and his hat. He gazed all around, but no wifey he found. So he said, where can Flossie be at? A note on the table he spied. He read it just once, then he cried. It ran, Louie dear, it's too slow for me here, so I think I will go for a ride. Meet me in St. Louis, meet me at the fair. Don't tell me the lights are shining any place but there. We will dance the hoochie coochie. I will be your tootsie woopsie if you will meet me in St. Louis, meet me at the fair. If you will meet me in St. Louis,